We have now explored at some length the insights from non-ordinary states concerning the dimensions of human consciousness, the model of the human psyche, and we saw that the current understanding that we have in academic psychiatry and psychology is very superficial and incomplete, doesn't make it possible to understand the kind of experiences and observations that happen when we work with non-ordinary states. And I've tried to outline the vastly expanded cartography that has emerged from this work that we need to deal with the phenomena that we observe. And I mentioned that besides the biographical realm and the Freudian individual unconscious, we have to add these two new domains, the perinatal, which is related to the trauma of birth and to the process of psychospiritual transformation, the process of death-rebirth, and then the vast domain that we now call transpersonal. And we'll now look at the new understanding that also emerged out of this work of what we can call architecture or geometry of emotional and psychosomatic disorders, or something that's conventionally called psychopathology or abnormal psychology. The field of psychiatry basically is dominated by the medical model. We can see it already from the terms that we are using: psychopathology, emotional disorders, mental disease, and the fact that we relate to people who have these kinds of difficulties as patients. Now, historically, the fact that psychiatry became a subspecialty of medicine has its origin in last century, where there was tremendous progress of a variety of disciplines: microscopy, laboratory techniques, pathological anatomy, microbiology, and so on. And at a certain point, these new techniques were also applied in psychiatric facilities, particularly in the locked wards, with the hope that somehow this will provide some kind of clues for the understanding of these disorders. And actually, initially, there were some successes. There were conditions where the researchers could find some biological, some organic basis in the form of infections, in the form of some degenerative diseases, in the form of some vascular diseases. But the success was really relatively limited. The longer the researchers continued, the less they were finding, until it became clear that the vast majority of psychiatric patients really does not show any, you know, very clear medical conditions that would account somehow for the psychological changes. And this was a major impetus for the development of another line of research, which was basically an attempt at psychological understanding of these disorders. And historically, this is linked particularly with one person, with Sigmund Freud, who almost single-handedly laid the foundations for depth psychology, as it is called now. He basically discovered the dynamics of the unconscious. He gave the interpretation of the symbolism of the neurotic symptoms, suggested how we can interpret dreams, discovered the importance of traumas in infancy or childhood for the development of emotional disorders, brought even insights into such areas as what he called psychopathology of everyday life, slips of the tongue and similar kinds of things. And then he also laid the foundations for psychotherapy, discovered the technique of free associations, the dynamics of transference analysis, and so on. A major, major pioneering effort. And his work inspired many other people, first a small circle of researchers in his so-called Viennese circle, and then there's hundreds of professionals all over the world. And the combined effort of these people laid a foundation of quite comprehensive understanding of emotional and psychosomatic disorders, at least those that don't have any clear biological or organic basis. Now, the essence of Freud's approach to this problem of psychopathology was to link different types of disorders to disturbances of the development of the sexual drive, of the libidinal drive, and also the development of object relations, where the idea is that at the beginning the little infant is kind of in love with itself and then gradually kind of attaches the libido two figures from his or her environment, the mother, the father, the siblings, and then a larger society. Freud's major discovery was described in his book Three Contributions to Sexual Theory, where he emphasized the fact that sexuality doesn't begin in puberty, that it actually begins very early in the nursing infant, where the oral zone is the primary libidinal zone, that the emphasis then shifts later during the time of the toilet training at the age of maybe 2-3 to the anal zone, then from there to the urethral zone, still related to the process of toilet training. And then around the age of 4, the attention and the emphasis shifts to the penis and to the clitoris. This is what Freud called the phallic stage. Now, according to him, when there is in any of these stages some problem, which could be actually overindulgence in the libidinal satisfaction, or the opposite, which is some kind of frustration of the libidinal drives, it creates what he called fixation, some kind of increased energetic charge in that area, which on the one hand interferes with further development because part of the energy remains kind of arrested in an earlier stage, but on the other hand also a point of possible regression, so that when in the future the individual ran into some problems, the libidinal energy would regress and flow back to the area of major fixation. Now, Freud and then his followers sort of created a kind of a dynamic classification of emotional and psychosomatic disorders, linking them to disturbances in the different stages of the libidinal development. This is a scheme that was put together by Carl Abraham, all the observations from the early psychoanalysis. Now, according to Carl Abraham, even psychotic disturbances can be understood psychologically, and they represent fixation and then regression to very early period of libidinal development. Carl Abraham differentiated within the oral zone, the passive oral zone, which is associated with the period of sucking, and then the active oral period, which coincides with teething and biting. According to this scheme, a person who is schizophrenic would have a history of very severe disturbances extremely early in the oral stage, in the passive oral stage, so that when that person runs into difficulties, he or she regresses all the way to the earliest stage of development. At the time, because there is some serious dissatisfaction in relation to the mother, there would be sort of perception of the maternal organism as being essentially hostile. This can, for example, lead to delusions concerning something like an influencing machine. Many of the schizophrenic patients feel under some kind of noxious influence of a machine or some kind of other external factor. And in Abraham's scheme, this would be then interpreted as feelings that originally were addressed to the maternal body, to the body of the nursing mother. The active oral period would then, according to this scheme, be associated with manic depressive disorders. The idea here is that there is a hostility that is oriented towards the nursing mother, and that hostility is then introjected, is sort of turned inside, so that, for example, something like suicide in this kind of thinking would be interpreted as killing of the introjected object, something that originally was hostility towards something outside that became then part of the individual. Two additional disorders that would be associated in this scheme with the oral zone would be then alcoholism and addiction, which would be linked to oral frustration. When the primary disturbance happens at the time of the toilet training that focuses on the anal zone, it would create a disposition to another kind of disorder, which would be the obsessive compulsive neurosis, where the patient is basically tortured by returning, recurrent kind of ideas which themselves are irrational, but the patient cannot get rid of them, and also by compulsions to do something, some irrational behavior, ritualistic behavior, that does not make any sense. Now, this, according to the psychoanalytic scheme, would be considered to be a result of a regression back to the anal period, kind of a pressure of the anal impulses that become unacceptable because of the superego, because of the conscience of the patient, and the obsessive-compulsive symptoms occur then as a result of the conflict between these two forces, as a compromise between the instinctual drive and the defense mechanism that is trying to suppress it. In a very similar way, the urethral stage would then create a disposition, if there are any problems, frustration and so on, overindulgence, would create disposition for pathological ambition, feelings of inferiority, fear of blunder, and a tendency to overcompensate it into excessive ambition and perfectionism. And then some major disturbance happens in the phallic stage, which is around the age of 4, when another very important dynamic is occurring, which is something that Freud called the Oedipus and the Electra complex. The Oedipus complex is a little boy's hostile attitude towards the father as a rival and affection for the mother, and the Electra complex is the mirror image for a little girl, which is hostility towards the mother figure and feelings of love towards the father figure. Now, if there is a major problem here, a fixation on this stage, then regression during the time of some difficulties will then create symptoms of hysteria, which in traditional psychoanalysis has two forms. The first one is anxiety hysteria, which primarily manifests as pathological fears, as phobias. And the other form of hysteria is called conversion hysteria, where the psychological conflicts are expressed in physical language. So this would involve symptoms like hysterical blindness, hysterical loss of the voice, it's called aphonia, hysterical paralysis of the arms or the legs, hysterical pregnancy, or so-called hysterical seizure, where the person would be lying on the floor doing a lot of stylized movements, very theatrical, frequently with kind of a sexual undertone, and usually is kind of laughing and crying at the same time. So these are the main examples of the early Freudian approach to the understanding of emotion on psychosomatic disorders. Now, what is characteristic for all these interpretations is that they are limited to postnatal biography and to the individual unconscious, as Freud described it. The idea here is that the newborn is what Freud called tabula rasa, which means clean slate. The newborn is like a virginal terrain, and what that child becomes depends on the relationship with the mother, father, the siblings, the different psychosexual traumas, you know, the dynamics in the family and so on. Later development in psychoanalysis, which led to ego psychology, basically didn't change anything on this fundamental fact that everything is being interpreted from postnatal event, if we are dealing with psychologically determined disorders, because this doesn't apply to biologically or organically determined disorders. So the ego psychology then put a lot of emphasis on object relations and sort of refined the understanding of the interaction within the family and so on, the development of object relationships. But it shares with classical sort of Freudian analysis the fact that it's limited to biography. Everything that's not organic should be understandable from postnatal life. It's nothing of interest for a psychologist that precedes birth, and that includes birth itself. Now, this obviously is very strange because of the intensity and the duration of the traumatization that occurs during birth. We are talking here about something that could be anything between an hour and maybe 50 hours of traumatic experiences where life is threatened. And this is not seen by traditional or new psychoanalysis as being psychotraumatic. And at the same time, the immediately following period, which is the early oral period, the nursing, is seen as something that can have tremendous relevance for the rest of the life of the individual, which of course is not a very logical way of approaching the problem. If the child didn't notice that anything strange was happening when it was being born, it will take a very long time before it can distinguish nuances of nursing or the way the mother is sort of treating and holding him or her and so on. Now, when we look at this, we'll see that the explanation in these terms is really incomplete. There are many aspects of these disorders that cannot be explained using this particular conceptual framework, and we'll explore it when we get to some concrete examples. It has been by and large accepted by the majority of psychiatrists for psychoneurosis and psychosomatic disorders. It was not seen as being completely convincing in relation to depression, where most psychiatrists would distinguish reactive depression, which can be psychologically understood, and so-called endogenous depression, which supposedly has some kind of unknown biological basis, where the psychological factors don't seem to be adequate or sufficient to explain what we are dealing with. And absolute majority of psychiatrists found this absolutely unconvincing as far as schizophrenia or some major psychotic disorders are concerned. What I would like to show now is when we now approach these disorders using the large cartography that we are talking about and using the observations from non-ordinary states, that we get a much deeper, complete understanding of these disorders, and we also get clues about completely new treatment strategies that are not available as long as we think about these disorders in terms of psychoanalysis. So we can say now that there are, you know, certain disorders that psychiatrists are treating which are truly organic. Those are primarily the so-called organic psychosis, where the current medical techniques, laboratory techniques, can really discover medical causes for these problems. Now, strictly speaking, these disorders really belong to neurology because they would be diagnosed by neurological methods. They would be treated by neurological methods. The reason why these people get to psychiatrists is because neurologists don't want to deal with the management problems in these patients. But strictly speaking, they're not psychiatric patients. So we're really left with a large group of people who have now emotional and psychosomatic problems, and we don't have any adequate medical explanation. Now, strictly speaking, we should not be referring to these disorders as diseases. They're not diseases in the same sense in which diabetes or anemia are diseases. For something to be a disease in the medical sense, this is referred to as nosological unit. Nosos means disease. We have to know something about the causes, about the etiology. We have to be able to understand how from these causes symptoms develop, which is called pathogenesis. We should be able to say something about the prognosis for this particular disorder. But particularly, we should be able to use this rational understanding of the disease and develop a sort of appropriate treatment. Now, none of this is really the case in these sort of psychiatric disorders in the narrower sense when we exclude the neurological cases. We have certainly tried to do diagnosis, which is something very important in medicine. In medicine, the success of treatment will critically depend on the correct diagnosis. If I make a diagnosis, somebody who's a better doctor than I am can show me that my diagnosis was wrong and that for that reason my therapy is not appropriate. Now, that situation is very different in psychiatry. In psychiatry, if we take a patient and let the patient be assessed by 10 psychiatrists, it's very likely that they will very vastly diverge as far as the diagnosis is concerned. Different countries have different classifications. The French classification is very different from the Australian and from the American and so on. But what is even worse is even if the psychiatrist would agree on the diagnosis, it doesn't commit them to any kind of specific treatment, which is the case in medicine. So we find, for example, psychiatrists who would be giving electroshocks to neurotics, and we found psychiatrists who would be doing psychotherapy
was psychotic. So the diagnosis that we make has really no direct relevance for treatment, which is the situation in medicine, of course. So we shouldn't really talk in psychiatry about diseases. And if we would sort of push hard, psychiatrists, he would have to admit, or she would have to admit, that what we treat are not really diseases. We think about these things in terms of symptoms and syndromes. Symptoms are certain fundamental building blocks of emotional disorders, such as anxiety, depression, obsessive-compulsive problems, and so on. And then syndromes are certain specific clusters of symptoms that we see frequently. And what I would like to show now is how we get a much, much deeper understanding as to why we have certain symptoms in psychiatry and also why they cluster in these particular syndromes. And I would begin with anxiety, which I think most psychotherapists would consider to be the most fundamental symptoms. A lot of patients who come to us have either free-floating anxiety or they suffer from different phobias. Or we can show that many other symptoms are actually ways of dealing with anxiety or bind the underlying anxiety. For example, patients who are obsessive-compulsive, if they try to suppress their obsessions and compulsions, they start experiencing anxiety. Now, Freud himself saw anxiety as something related to sexuality, to the libido, something that comes from repression of libidinal impulses. If we are repressing our libido, we start experiencing anxiety. Now, there was a problem in this definition because the major way of suppressing sexuality is through emotions, and one significant emotion that can do it is anxiety. So we have anxiety coming from repressed libido, but also anxiety is one of the significant factors that are involved in the suppression of the libido. Freud wasn't very satisfied with it, and actually for a short period of his life he toyed with the idea that maybe all anxiety can be traced back to the anxiety experienced by the child during the passage through the birth canal. He actually was pointing out certain linguistic connections, that in many languages the word for anxiety is closely connected to narrowness or narrow passage. He specifically mentions in Latin anxiety is anxietas, and it's related to angustie, which is a narrow canyon. In German we have, for example, ang is narrow and angst is fear. In some of the Slavic languages like Russian or Czech, there's actually the same word used for anxiety and for narrowness, something narrow. Now, for some reason, he did not stay with this idea. He abandoned it very quickly, and it was picked up by his disciple Otto Rank, who pursued it kind of secretly and wrote a whole book which is called The Birth Trauma and had it published and didn't tell anything Freud or most of his colleagues until the book was printed and handed it to Freud. Freud's biographer Ernest Jones describes the situation and says that after Freud read this book he went into a state of shock that lasted 4 months, and the reason for this was that he believed that Rank might have sort of stolen his historical stage, that in retrospect Rank's contribution will be seen as more important than his own. And after these 4 months he was able to give a kind of fair statement saying that this is a very important theory, second only to the discovery of psychoanalysis by himself, and that it would be important to study people with difficult delivery, easy delivery, caesarean patients, and see what the psychological correlates are. And then he started getting letters from psychoanalysts, particularly from Berlin, who were warning him that this is a very explosive doctrine, that it's going to split the psychoanalytic movement. And because of political concerns, Freud finally excommunicated Rank, and this theory never really made it into psychoanalysis or into mainstream psychiatry. Something similar later happened also with Carl Gustav Jung, who came up with the idea that there's not just the individual unconscious but also collective unconscious. He was talking about the mythological dimensions of the psyche, about archetypes and so on. many of the things that we would now discuss in the context of transpersonal psychology. I'm mentioning this because I want to show that the cartography that we were talking about before, this expanded cartography that came out of the work with non-ordinary state, really is not something that's absolutely new. The elements of it emerged in the history of psychoanalysis, but the people who proposed these theories were seen as renegades and really did not have lasting influence. They're kind of footnotes in psychiatric handbooks, but their work is not considered to be relevant, in spite of the fact that particularly Jung's ideas are now becoming very influential in the lay circles than in kind of paraprofessional circles. But certainly in the context of traditional psychiatry, they still haven't made a mark. If we now look at the problem of anxiety from the observations in non-ordinary states, we'll find out that anxiety is linked to life-threatening situations. In nature, anxiety is a signal that the organism is threatened. Either the survival or the integrity of the organism is threatened, and that's the function of anxiety, to mobilize the animal either to fight or to flight. So what we see when we work with people who have problems with anxieties is that they trace it back to anxiety-provoking situations, very frequently actually physically threatening situations. For example, situations of near drowning, situations of operations and injuries, which still kind of as undigested material in the unconscious. So this is the biographical aspect. Then we find out that there's a tremendous pool of anxiety which is connected to the birth trauma, as Freud very correctly saw, at least for the time when he entertained the idea. So birth really involves an element of death. If nothing else, even the easiest delivery, in a sense, is death of the fetus. It's death of one very specific form of existence as an aquatic creature, and then birth into a whole new form of existence as an air-breathing organism. But usually the passage is quite difficult, and in the extremes can be really life-threatening for the child and the mother. So there are different degrees of vital threat that are involved in birth, and people who have anxiety problems usually trace them back beyond the biographical sources to the trauma of birth, and they can actually free themselves from large amounts of anxiety by bringing the birth trauma fully into consciousness and expressing the emotions and the physical energies which are pent up in connection with that trauma. So this is anxiety in general. We talk about free-floating anxiety. For many patients, the anxiety is actually linked to specific objects. And then we talk about phobias or pathological fears. So a classical phobia, for example, would be claustrophobia that many people suffer from, which means they would come to a situation where there's some kind of narrow, crowded space, like the typical situations would be an elevator, a subway, or a small room that doesn't have any windows and has a lot of people in it. And they suddenly start feeling trapped and threatened, and they might start having breathing difficulties, and they have to leave that situation. They have to run out. Now, when we work with these people using the holotropic method or the psychedelic method, we'll find out that they would discover something in their childhood that links to it, which would be like a situation of being choked by an older brother under a pillow, being locked into a closet or into a cellar repeatedly by the parents, being bound or being subjected to some kind of forceful medical interventions. Like, I've worked with quite a few people in Europe who had the traumatic experience of tonsillectomy, where they were actually, as children, they were bound to the chair, and this was done in local anesthesia, and they were choking on the blood and so on that was flowing down their throat. So we can find these kinds of biographical components, but then as the process goes deeper, we'll find that claustrophobia is linked to the onset of the birth process when the uterus starts kind of closing in. They have literally the feeling that everything is kind of closing in, that they're getting into a kind of a no-exit situation where they are trapped and cannot breathe. And then there could be additional deeper sources of a transpersonal nature, for example, past life situations that would involve some kind of a stay in a dungeon, a torture chamber of the Inquisition, or some other situations where they were trapped and victimized and helpless. Another very common phobia is agoraphobia, which seems to be the opposite. These people are afraid of moving out of a confined place like the house into a place where there are no confines, like a large square or a broad street, for example. But when we actually work with people who are agoraphobic, we found out they're also claustrophobic, but they are more afraid of the transition out of a closed place than they are of the closed place itself. Now, this kind of problem in experiential work would be traced actually to the last stage of birth, which we talked about the matrices, so it would be the transition from the third matrix to the fourth matrix, when the person is just totally compressed and confined, and suddenly there is a transition to a state where there are no boundaries, and psychologically that transition feels like facing annihilation. So when we work with people who get to that stage, we actually give them a lot of encouragement, because they are just one step from a major liberation, but their inner experience is that they're facing annihilation. And psychologically, actually, they are facing the experience of the ego death before the rebirth. Another very closely related phobia is thanatophobia. Thanatos means death in Greek, and phobos means fear. So it's a pathological fear of death. These are people who could be young, absolutely healthy, and they would be experiencing fear of death. They have a sense that they have some kind of condition that's going to kill them. They have the feeling that they cannot breathe, that they're going to choke to death, or they have the feeling of pressure in their head and they feel they're going to have a stroke, or they start having palpitations and they're afraid they're going to have a heart attack. So they usually go to a physician, they have a full examination, and the examination doesn't bring anything that would explain their problem. But they, of course, feel the symptoms, which are very convincing, so they usually want the second opinion. And if the second opinion is negative, they might want the third opinion. And then sooner or later, they might become a kind of menace for the hospitals or for the medical personnel. And to get rid of them, they send them to a psychiatrist. And psychiatrists usually don't treat them much better, because psychiatrists are physicians, and they look at the medical records and they found out there's absolutely no reason. So they see it as something that these people are imagining, and these patients are usually not taken very seriously. Now, from the perspective of non-ordinary states, what underlies this kind of problem would be some undigested memories of situations that actually were life-threatening, which could be like a near drowning or a whooping cough or some kind of accident. Then on a deeper level, it could be the vital threat that existed in the birth canal during the birth process. And then behind it, transpersonally, there could be a past life experience of being killed or dying. So in the experiential process, these people always discover the source of this fear of death as being a situation that actually was a life-threatening situation. So the error of these patients is that they link somehow the fear to a current, to a present process, where it's actually the source of the fear is a situation which is life-threatening, so the feelings are real, but it's historically misplaced. And the resolution of that is to bring that fully into consciousness, relive that situation in the original context, and then express the feelings which are involved. A related problem is called nosophobia. I already mentioned that nosos is disease in Greek. So nosophobia is fear of disease. A thanatophobic patient feels that their life is threatened. They might die, which means they have a physical problem that's so serious that it's going to kill them immediately. It's a kind of an emergency sense. Whereas a person who is nosophobic has just the feeling that they have some disease, possibly even serious disease, but not one that would kill them today or tomorrow. Again, in the same way, what we find out is that the source of these various physical discomforts that they interpret as symptoms of a current disease are actually physical symptoms associated with some situation that belongs to the past. And the same approach to solution, of course, would be to bring that situation fully into consciousness and process the emotions and the physical feelings. Some patients have very specific fear of diseases. For example, cancerophobia. People don't just feel that they're sick, but they have very specific idea that they have a tumor. They feel pressure in the head and they're sure this is a brain tumor, or they feel pain in the back and they feel it's a metastasis into their spine. Today, a number of patients have phobia of AIDS. And there's one specific form of phobia which has a somewhat different origin, which is called mysophobia, M-Y-S-O, which is a phobia of dirt, phobia of something that is unclean. Those are people who are sort of pathologically meticulous about cleanliness, people who wouldn't touch doorknobs except through a handkerchief, people who don't trust that plates or bowls, you know, have been sort of adequately washed, and they have fantasies about situations that might have sort of contaminated these objects. For example, somebody went to the bathroom and didn't wash their hand, or the cook had her period and didn't wash her hands, and so on. So it's a fear of dirt, particularly biological dirt, which could endanger the person himself or herself, but very frequently they also feel that that would make them dangerous to others. They would get infected and then infect others. So there's element of kind of an aggressive feeling towards oneself, but also towards others. That frequently leads to compulsive washing of hands. I've worked with patients who would wash their hands with a brush thoroughly 100 times a day until the hands were bleeding and they still didn't feel that the hands are clean. This can usually be linked to some kind of unpleasant contact with the biological material in birth, particularly a situation where some of that material is inhaled, when there's a premature breathing and the biological material gets into the lungs. And so the child is aware, is in touch with the biological material, and at the same time it experiences different degrees of danger and discomfort because the breathing is obstructed. So what remains in the memory is a kind of a negative association between this biological material and fear. The next very interesting phobia that also exists in a number of people is called acrophobia, which is a phobia of heights. This is not a pure phobia like mysophobia, which is a fear of dirt but also compulsive washing. Acrophobia is not a pure phobia. Usually people who are gifted in introspection will tell you that when they are somewhere in a high place, it's not just a fear of that height, but there is behind it is a compulsion to jump. So there is a sudden kind of unconscious impulse that emerges into consciousness which is telling them jump. There is a kind of need to experience the fall, and then the fear then comes basically as a fear of that impulse that could sabotage us so that we could hurt ourselves. Now, this is one that is not so easy to link to birth, although we see regularly that people in the very final stages of birth have experiences related to falling. For example, somebody in the breathwork session or a psychedelic session is reliving birth and suddenly from there goes into an identification with a paratrooper jumping with a parachute, or suddenly has the identification with an Olympic athlete who is doing fancy diving into a swimming pool and so on. So there is a peculiar kind of mysterious connection between the final stages of birth and the experience of falling. There are different ways of thinking about it. One is possibly phylogenetic, that there are species that actually deliver standing. For example, a giraffe delivers standing. So for the little giraffe, birth is quite a drop. In cultures that don't have obstetricians, women typically don't deliver on their backs. That's the worst possible position. So women who have their own choice, follow their instincts, they would deliver squatting or on all four, or in some cultures even standing, sort of maybe suspended on a branch. This was, for example, something that was shown in the movie The Little Buddha, when Queen Maya is delivering the Buddha. She's delivering him standing. But in any case, so there's a possibility of falling, and there's certainly a first encounter with gravity. So for some reason, there's some similarity between, or some connection between, the experience of falling and the final stages of birth. So people who are acrophobic typically discover that connection. We had a very interesting man in our workshop at Hollyhock, which is in British Columbia, who was from Germany, but he lived at the time in Canada, but he was in Germany through the Second World War. And before the war, when Hitler came to power and they were preparing the Olympics, there was a strong sort of ideological element. They wanted to show the supremacy of the Nordic race. So there was tremendous investment in winning in the Olympics. So some outstanding athletes were put into special camps where they would undergo real drill, real training. And for the men, this was an alternative to going into the army, into the Wehrmacht. And this man was kind of a talented athlete. He was also a pacifist. He didn't want to be in the army. So he was in one of these camps. And they were grading, very strictly grading, all the performances. And the athletes who didn't live up to the expectations, they were sent to the army. And he was kind of lagging behind. He didn't have enough grades. And then he came into a situation where he had a chance to get a lot of grades. But it was something that he never had done before, which was dive headfirst from a tower, which was, he said, about 60 feet, and sort of do a perfect dive into the swimming pool. At the beginning of this workshop, he told us that he was suffering from phobia of heights. And during the experience, he had this very powerful insight into it, where he actually linked it to three situations. It was like a constellation of memories on different levels. I talk about this sometimes as a coex system, a system of condensed experience, where the first part of it was a reliving of the situation in the Olympic camp, where he suddenly found himself standing on this high tower, facing the situation, you know, either you do this or you go to the army, with tremendous conflict, and finally doing it, forcefully overcoming his anxiety. And then from there it went to the final stages of birth, and then when he completed that, then suddenly he was like in a, what he felt was a past life, in a culture that he felt was something like New Guinea. He was an adolescent boy involved in a rite of passage, where what they did, they built a tower, you know, made of poles, trunks, and so on, and they would take lianas and bind one end of the liana to the top of the tower, and the other one on their ankles, and they would jumping from the tower head first, and it was a kind of a status symbol in this group to have the longest liana and not to get killed. The head comes as close to the ground as possible. So this was like a coex system, very, very deeply meaningfully related to his phobia of heights, which had these two experiences of falling on both ends, one biographical, one transpersonal, and in the middle was the experience of the final stages of birth. Then we have a large category of phobias which are called zoophobias, the fear of various animals. Again, besides whatever biographical components there might be, there's always a connection to the perinatal level. For example, we talked about the fact that the beginning of birth typically feels like being engulfed, being swallowed. And a lot of these phobias of large animals are associated with the fear of being swallowed. The fear of the animal is linked to the fear of being swallowed. There are other phobias where we need to know the specific symbolism which is associated with the perinatal matrices. So, for example, many people in the second matrix would have experience, kind of archetypal experience, of a tarantula, of a giant spider that takes the freedom of the fly or the butterfly. The butterfly in ordinary life has basically the freedom to go anywhere. It lives in a kind of unobstructed universe. And when the spider web comes and the spider, it takes the freedom away. It wraps the insect and life is threatened. It's a situation that's very similar to the fetus going into the birth process. And people who have arachnophobia, who have fear of spiders, they are very close to the memory of the beginning of birth. And when they see what the spider is doing to the fly, it sort of activates their own fear and then gets linked to the spiders as such. You might have seen the Steven Spielberg movie, you know, Arachnophobia. So many of the blockbuster movies really draw on the perinatal symbolism. You can think about Jaws, for example, where it's a different kind of interruption of the oceanic situation. It's again something that the fetus goes through, going from the kind of aquatic freedom to a situation of being engulfed, of being devoured. The Shawshank Redemption, the escape from a prison through the sewage system, is a very powerful perinatal symbolism, and so on. Snakes are very powerful perinatal symbols, particularly the boa constrictor snakes that swallow the prey so that they look pregnant, but they also have the habit of twisting their body around the prey and crushing. So some of the phobias of snakes have that kind of a deep unconscious connection. The viper type of a snake usually stands for the fear of imminent death. So we see that we have a different level of understanding of the symbol of the snake, which in traditional psychoanalysis always is interpreted as being related to the penis. We have then also many different ways of understanding the symbolism of the snake on the transpersonal level, where we have to identify the archetypal domain from which that symbol comes. For example, the snake symbolizing the Kundalini is a very different kind of a snake than the snake from the Garden of Eden. And that's very different from the plumed serpent of the Aztecs or the rainbow serpent of the Australian Aborigines. So on the transpersonal level, the snakes have very different meaning depending on the archetypal context.
This concludes side A. Please turn the tape over for side B.